fantasy. Caught in a landslide. Hello and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast for two siblings who love books.
We hated them for a while, so we decided not to do any more episodes.
I just say we love books, we just didn't like you guys anymore.
But then, Christmas and Jesus or whatever, convinced us to, I don't know.
That's right. I followed the star, and at the end of it, I didn't find Jesus. That's absurd. But I found some books. So Ethan, I decided to read them.
Ethan went back to Ithaca, and my sense of hatred and cynicism lifted up off of me, much like the dome, and I was able to once again restore my relationship with the outside world.
That works. We'll blame it on Ethan.
Fuck you, Ethan.
That's right. You get all the blame, but it's only because you're the evil brother.
Also, you don't listen to the podcast. Who cares?
Yeah, exactly. You'll never hear this.
So, just in case you need a reminder, I'm Gabs.
I'm Ben.
And today we are going to be talking about Under the Dome by Stephen King.
It's big.
It is quite large. Much to Stephen King's style, or he wrote a pretty hefty book.
Yeah, it's a... So some people don't like it when a book is really long, and it occurs to me that most of the books I've been reading since, I don't know, this summer have been 700,000-800,000 page books.
Ben refuses to read a book unless it is more than 500 pages.
Apparently. There was the second half of the Harry Potter series, and I was into the Honor Harrington stuff, which at some point in that series, those all started being 700 or to 1,000 page long books, and I'm looking at my bookshelf, and I'm seeing George R.R. Martin and Wheel of Time. And
oh, God. Wheel of Time, a book series I will never read.
A book series you should never read, in fact. Because you would not enjoy it even a little bit. And I enjoyed it, but I tend to reread like a maniac with stuff that I like, and I think at some point I probably will try that with that series, maybe in another 10 years or so. But
once the memories have faded,
It'll be interesting to see if I can get through a couple of those books a second time. Because Under the Dome, you might argue that it could use some editing, just because with any 1,000-page book, you can at least start to make that argument.
How many stories actually need to be 1,000 or more pages right. long?
I mean, fantasy novels are notorious for being double length. It's kind of expected for some reason, with certain types of fantasy at least.
Yeah.
And Wheel of Time, I would say after the first or second book, every single one is padded out at least 200 pages too long.
Yeah.
At least. And one of them, I don't remember which one in the sequence, because there are 1,015 of them. but one of those books in the sequence, I swear, was 900 pages long, and 700 of them could have been cut. There was one that I would probably read the first and last chapter and just move to the next one.
So I've heard is one or two of those books are basically filler.
Yeah. There's a lot of people sitting around talking about things that happened in the last book, but not doing anything.
Hooray!
Yay! And descriptions of their cleavage, because Robert Jordan was spending too much time alone with his word processor.
Maybe he and George R. R. Martin could get together in that one.
Well, Robert Jordan is dead.
Right.
Which is, I think he might be the example that makes everybody fear George R. R. Martin's pace specifically.
Yes.
They're we've seen this before, George. Hurry up.
I know that we have not talked much about Under the Dome yet, but I did want to mention really quickly that when I finally finished reading A Dance with Dragons, I got online and was poking around, and I saw some comment on Goodreads or something that was it was just announced that the sixth book is going to be released next year or whatever. And I was oh, cool. And then I looked at the date on that comment, and someone had written that in, like, 2010.
Shocking.
And I was like, even back when that was written, like, people had been waiting, like, a year or more. I was like, oh my god. Like, yep. Who knows when the sixth one of those is going to come out?
Infamously slow.
Yeah. Everyone's afraid he's just going to drop dead.
They should be more afraid that he just stages a holocaust in the sixth book and ends it with the sixth one.
Yeah. Like, everyone dies.
Because the pace has been going, that should not even be close to happening in the sixth book. Yeah. But I wouldn't put it past the man.
Well, he is Gurm.
He is Gurm.
Well, if he dies, then Stephen King could write the next one, and then everyone would just die.
Maybe they'll let Brandon Sanderson finish that series, too. He did a pretty good job with Wheel of Time. His books are arguably the best ones in the series. Which, again, has very little to do with Under the Dome. You weren't listening to the Under the Dome episode, hoping we talked about it. Be funny.
You wanted to hear about a lot of random fantasy, right?
It'd be funny if we just talked about fantasy novels the whole podcast.
At the very end, we're like, yeah, Under the Dome, it was good.
Next, like, all right. Yeah, for the next hour and a half, like a long episode even. It's like, let's talk about the Lord of the Rings again.
You know, we did read The Two Towers and never recorded that episode.
I know, and at this point, I'd probably have to reread it again to record that episode.
Definitely have to reread it again.
I don't know if I want to.
Yeah, as it turns out, Tolkien, not that interesting.
Sorry.
Lord of the Rings movies, totally awesome.
The rare example of where even I think the movies are probably better than the books. They're certainly easier to consume.
Except The Hobbit. If you like The Hobbit movies, fuck you.
Well, I haven't seen those, so I'll reserve judgment.
So anyway, Under the Dome. We read it, partly because we, you know, read Stephen King a while ago, and he's written a fuck ton of books, and it was about time to read another Stephen King book.
Yep, and one or two people have heard of him, so.
Yeah, a couple people know him. Ben had read it before and had recommended it to me just as, like, as a general to-read book, not as a podcast book. And then, I don't know how much anyone watches TV, but over the summer they did release the first season of a television show called Under the Dome, which I thought was, like, going to be a four-part mini-series, and it turns out it was actually the first season of a television show that was intended to be multiple seasons long. So, as anyone can imagine, it diverts wildly from the plot of the book.
As it would have to.
Yeah.
Unless you're going to be like a season for every 24-hour period in the book or something.
Yeah. Because as Ben and I were saying, like, this book, you could turn into a mini-series, but it would be like, you know, four or five nights, probably.
Yeah, I mean, you could make a really solid one, I think, out of it. A really solid miniseries. Depends how long you wanted each part to be, but
it's only an hour a pop.
Yeah. I don't know how you would make a television show out of it. But then again, I will point out that the show Haven is technically based on The Colorado Kid, which is like a 100-page novelette by Stephen King. And I don't know which season it's on, but there's more than one.
Oh. I had no idea.
It's actually kind of a fun little show. Not to divert again, but
It is interesting sometimes to read the source material and then see what people make of it. And go, how did the author get that? How did the creator of this show or movie get that from the book that they read?
Right.
How did the book that I read turn into this? You know?
Sometimes it's clearly just a jumping off point. They go, oh, there's a supernatural mystery. Well, I'm just going to make a show about supernatural mysteries and claim it was inspired by it.
Yeah.
Which is more or less what Haven is. And other times I'll try to follow the source material a little more closely, like the Lord of the Rings movies.
If anyone has seen season one of the new show Sleepy Hollow, based on that tiny little short story we read.
That's right.
obviously just a jumping off point because that show is hilarious and ridiculous. And I actually do really enjoy it, but it is out of control and has nothing to do with the short story. So, Under the Dome.
Yes, the show reminded me that the book existed, and so it got put on our podcast list, I guess.
Yeah, Ben handed it to me to start reading at some point. You gave it to me a while ago. Yeah. And then I decided to start reading it, and then when I finished reading it, you said, yeah, let's just podcast it.
Might as well. You went to the trouble.
That's how professional we are.
That's our system.
Here at Novel Ideas.
Hey, the question has been asked before. What is your process? That is our process.
That was just an in-depth look into our process.
There is no process.
We're two siblings who just kind of hang out and randomly go, oh yeah, let's talk about a book.
Pretty much. Let's just record what we would say anyway.
That's pretty much how we roll. So, genre.
Is there a genre? The genre is Stephen King, I think.
That's what I just said. Yeah.
Supernatural thriller? Supernatural mystery?
The only problem I have attaching supernatural to it is I actually think there's very little supernatural happening in the book. Like, the presence of the dome in and of itself is supernatural, but, like, pretty much everything that happens inside of the dome, just pretty human.
That's true. Actually, the presence of the dome, you could even just say, is science fiction.
You're right, yeah.
It's not, it's supernatural, kind of, but maybe it's natural, but beyond us.
Yeah.
Clark's Law, or whatever it is. Any sufficiently advanced technology is, indistinguishable magic. From magic, yeah.
Right. So, and thriller, like, works to some degree, but at the same time, it's not, like, your typical action point, action point, action point. Like, you know, there's times where characters kind of sit around and think about things and stuff like that. I also think I'm just attaching the bad connotation to thriller, I guess, and maybe I'm not being fair, but I'd argue that Under the Dome is written better than what I would normally expect of what someone called a thriller.
Fair enough. Psychological drama?
As I'm saying, the genre is Stephen King.
He puts meandering exploration of people in a tight space.
Exactly. Put people in a small place and watch how they bounce off of each other.
Exactly.
Like, he loves doing that. That's basically what his books are.
Yeah, if you don't want to go to trouble to read this, read The Mist and you'll have the gist of it. It'll take about a tenth of the time.
Yeah. And then go watch the movie version.
Which is my recommendation. Surprisingly respectable.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
So, plot synopsis.
Aliens kill innocent woodchuck. Town goes crazy.
But not because the aliens killed the woodchuck.
Oh, yeah. There's no causal relationship. This is our usual high-quality plot synopsis.
No, it's just sad that the woodchuck dies at the beginning. Gets cut in half.
Well, that was my takeaway from the introduction. I was sad about the woodchuck, and then all of a sudden the town starts going apeshit.
We're like, oh, they're all sad about the woodchuck.
They must be.
Oh, wait.
I had pathos with that woodchuck.
Wait a minute. Yeah. I find kind of funny about Stephen King's writing is, like, you usually hear of him as this horror writer, and you hear about, like, these books that he's written that are so scary, but then, like, when you read his stuff, he usually has, like, multiple, like, kind of goofy moments.
Yeah.
Like, the woodchuck scene is kind of, well, I mean, getting cut in half, I guess, is kind of sad, but the woodchuck perspective is mostly funny. Like, it's just kind of this little moment of, like, oh, I'm a woodchuck. And then, like, you know, the Stephen King shit starts happening, but his books aren't, like, 100% just serious, scary, bad stuff. And I think it'd be easy to think of his books that way if you hadn't really read them.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of them, I guess, go more down the traditional type of horror route, but I think it was all just, like, slashery violence that probably he wouldn't have written and sold as many books as he has.
Well, yeah.
Just a guess.
Well, I don't know. It depends. If you look at some of the books that sell, you might question
That's true.
Question that statement.
It's like half the time we read a bestseller, I'm just like, oh, this is... I mean, well, actually, I rarely go, oh, this is garbage, but I frequently go, this is kind of boring.
Like, this book sold 5 million copies, and we're like, eh.
Yeah.
It's all right.
All right.
Didn't change my life or anything.
I'm glad someone liked it.
I mean, Dan Brown's a Dan Brown, so whatever.
Yeah, there you go.
And The Alchemist, which is like, meh. Like, one of the most meh books I've ever read. I don't, like, can't even remember a single thing that happened in the fucking book. And if it had enraged me, I would remember every single detail.
Exactly.
In exacting order how much I loathed it.
But a level of hate we call the 50 Shades of Grey.
One of these days we'll read the sequel.
Nope.
No. Yeah, probably not.
No, we won't.
I'm not that interested. So, the essential conceit behind the book, which, if you can't figure it out by the title, I mean, it's pretty obvious, this dome thing falls over the town of Chester's Mill in Maine, and cannot be penetrated, and we immediately learn that when a plane crashes into it, and multiple giant cars crash into it, and a lot of people are dying and getting hurt, and nothing happens to the dome. So these people in the town are all trapped, and once they realize that they're all trapped, you kind of get what you would expect in the breakdown of society and a bunch of shit going awry and grabs for power and stuff like that. So it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah. It's easy enough to understand, I think. Well, I guess that includes that summary included where it is set. But the story is told from the point of view of the, third person close, I guess, from the point of view of the various characters in the story. Some of them more than others, but... nearly everyone for a paragraph or two at some point.
Yeah, some characters only get a very short amount. Some characters, like Barbie and Big Jim, get, you know, full chapters or whatever you might consider chapters in this book.
Yeah.
But yeah, he does a good job cycling through anyone of import and even some people who probably aren't that important, too. And giving you quick little glimpses into their brains, including, for example, one of the dogs in the town.
Yeah.
Which Ben really liked.
Yeah, I did enjoy Horace's moment in the sun.
And that's one thing, another Stephen King trademark, I guess, is having a lot of characters and kind of following them all around.
I mean, a book this size, I think, I can't really, off the top of my head, I can't think of a 1,000-page book that I've read that didn't do that.
Oh, like have a ton of characters?
Or, yeah, certainly that one that didn't have you jumping viewpoints.
Gotcha.
At least some of the time.
Yeah. I mean, first that was Game of Thrones, which obviously... switches viewpoints every chapter.
Yep.
Harry Potter's probably not quite long enough. Although it sticks with Harry.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the closest thing to an exception. I was trying to remember how often Atlas Shrugged bounced around.
Yeah. Well, let me think. So I read... I haven't read Gone with the Wind in a long time. But I'm pretty sure that book follows Scarlet around the entire time.
All right.
That's a long ass book.
So you can do it.
Yeah.
But I would guess it's more common to have the multiple characters and the largish cast in the big story just because you want to keep things interesting, yeah.
Yeah, like otherwise you probably don't need to be writing a 1,000-page book.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if your only goal in sitting down and writing it is to have 1,000 pages when you're done, that's one thing. You can do that however the hell you want. But my recommendation is that if you're going to do that, you do it in a way that you can sell the end result.
Yeah, and this story definitely works in that format. Like, if you're flying around an entire small town, I mean, obviously he doesn't follow around every single person in the town. But, you know, the power struggle is going on in the small town. You can't really just follow around one character because, like, you know, this character might be over here doing this with these three other people, and then you need to jump across town to where this other character is doing this, and this third character, and, like, they're all bouncing off of each other, and their actions all affect each other, so you do need to see it all.
Yeah. So with all these characters,
yeah,
who is the protagonist?
I would say Dale Barbara / Barbie.
Right.
Is pretty clearly the protagonist.
Yeah, I agree. And if you were, I guess if you were evil at heart, you could make the argument that Big Jim Rennie is the protagonist, but he's probably the classical antagonist. Yes.
We don't really talk about that very much.
Most books that we've read don't have as clear-cut an antagonist.
Yeah.
Or there'll be someone who is, like, I think in what, I guess what I think of as the more conventional antagonist is the guy who pops up to be a pain in the ass, but who isn't a character that you get to be deep inside the mind of all too often in most stories. I mean, gosh, when I even think of characters who are morally gray or even kind of morally reprehensible, where you get to spend a lot of time with them, they're still usually not antagonists. They end up being anti-heroes. They're the damn protagonist.
Yeah, yeah. Which is, like, the new favorite. I think that's the new hip trend, is to make your hero actually, like, a gray anti-hero sort of character.
It does. That does seem to be a little more trendy these days.
Yeah.
I agree. I guess Breaking Bad, which was the mania for that entire last season, is a pretty good example of that.
Yeah, I haven't really seen any of it.
I mean, I haven't really either.
That's what I've heard as an example people talk about a lot as well. I guess you could kind of call Don Draper in Mad Men one of those, except I personally just think he's a giant piece of shit, but that's a discussion for another time.
That kind of qualifies, though, really.
Oh, I just hate him.
The idea is, here's a main character that you don't necessarily, I guess you're not supposed to hate them, because that would make it hard to keep, you know, watching the show.
Yeah.
But you're obviously not supposed to sympathize with them. It's more like, oh, this is an interesting person. This is a magnificent bastard. Let's see. Let's see which pot they'll stir up next.
Yeah. Dale Barbara is not one of those, and I would actually say that neither is Big Jim Rennie.
No.
Dale is an ex-military guy and, you know, kind of a drifter, and his main thing is that he just kind of, like, wanders from town to town, and when the book starts, he's actually walking on his way out of town, so he's preparing to ditch everything, and the dome falls before he can. Kind of saves his life, because he, like, sees it get chopped in half and knows there's something there.
There you go.
But, I mean, you know, he has, like, some issues with, like, developing friendships and staying in one place and blah, blah, blah. But that's not really, like, anti-hero stuff. That's just more like, oh, here's a guy who's kind of messed up and has a hard time, like, making friends or whatever.
Well, we're kind of told that, but then at the same time, he seems to have established fast and firm friendships with several people.
I thought so, too. Gets along with people pretty easily.
Yeah, I think he just has trouble staying in one spot. And seems
more like the restless. Oh, who was it? Was the guy in Beloved who had, like, that restless spirit, and he kept, like, moving farther away from the house?
Yeah.
You're talking about?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
I can't remember the character's name.
Me neither. Because I'm good at this.
So helpful. And then Big Jim is more of an antagonist than, like, some kind of morally gray anti-hero type, because he's pretty clearly just a complete piece of crap. And even though, like, you get to spend a fair amount of time in his head, he does things like, you know, murder people and not care about it. Right. So, like, that's pretty messed up.
Kind of starts to get a little bit of a taste for it, arguably.
Yeah. Yeah. Like father, like son.
Yes. Yeah, actually, the good versus bad in this book is laid out on, like, almost to the level of, like, an old melodrama.
Yeah.
Like, almost absurdly so.
I was telling Ben that the big Jim Rennie characters drive me insane. Because, like, everything I kept learning about him, I was like, really? Like, he's even more of a dick than I thought. Oh, and in addition to, like, laundering money, he's doing this. Okay, like, this guy is a super big douche. And it's like, oh, and he has a secret meth lab in town. I was like, what the fuck? This guy is just, like, evil robber baron, like, oh, and then everything he does just works, and it makes me so mad.
And he doesn't swear because he's been saved.
Yeah.
That was one of the first things that was mentioned about him when he is introduced in the book. And so the first time I read it, I was like, oh, well, I immediately don't trust anyone like that. Like, anyone who comes into a situation where swearing is not only understandable, but basically required, and is like, what is this cluster mug? It's like, ooh, I'm going to want to punch you in the face before this book is over.
You're the worst.
You are so bad.
They don't even do anything except say that. You're the worst.
God damn it, Jim.
Yeah, and I mean, I haven't read a ton of Stephen King, but one of the things that I've come to understand is that Stephen King loves including super, like, a crazy religious person in all of his books. And in the case of Under the Dome, we have the priest of one of the churches who's, like, kind of going crazy.
Yeah.
Like, whipping himself and stuff. And then you have Big Jim, and, you know, I guess the thing he's trying to point out here is here's a guy who's, like, super duper religious and is saved, but he's, like, a huge hypocrite.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, I won't swear, but I will beat a man to death with a baseball.
Right. Well, and I will display the intent to swear. Like, every other word he says is...
Yeah.
Like, let's see. But that rhymes with witch.
Yeah.
Or Nosy Parker was one of the ones where I kind of wanted... Parker. Where I wanted to punch him in the face.
Yeah, what the hell is that?
That Nosy Parker rhymes with witch. I was like, ugh.
You're annoying.
Right.
Well, suffice it to say, Big Jim is...
I'm just gonna... So, if you're listening to this part of the conversation, I just deleted, like, the last 5 minutes, and we're just gonna say, Big Jim is a dick.
And moving on with our lives.
Moving on.
I'm sorry, I'm too tired.
So, Barbie...
Yes.
Is, he's very likable within this cast.
Yeah.
Because he's pretty smart, level-headed, easy to get along with. I suspect if he was in the cast of a different story, you'd go, eh, he's kind of boring.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering, because I don't have a ton of Stephen King, you know, to draw from, and The Stand is another giant book that Stephen King wrote that, you know, we read for the podcast, I've been drawing some comparisons, and I thought of Stuart Redman from The Stand as being like Barbie in Under the Dome, but then I was thinking, well, I like Barbie better than I like Stuart, because I remember when I read The Stand, I thought Stuart was pretty boring, but... Like, they're kind of the same character, so maybe Barbie in The Stand would have been as boring as Stuart was.
Maybe. It's hard to say. I also like Barbie better, and I don't know if there's something about the character that's just a little more interesting, or if it is just that he's surrounded by so many infuriating people in Under the Dome that just anyone who seems to be operating on common sense... more often than anything else, is all of a sudden, like, a good character that you really like.
He's, like, the straight man in the worst comedy ever written.
Yeah. Right. He's a straight man in a comedy where no one is funny and everyone's a dick.
And the other, you know, good characters that kind of surround him all have a little more something going on. So I would say the main big third character would be Julia Shumway, who is the owner, editor, operator of the local newspaper. And she ends up falling into cahoots with Barbie because she has an operating cell phone and the colonel on the outside is trying to get a hold of him, and then they end up, you know, teaming up because both of them are trying to figure out what's going on and both think Big Jim's a dick. And yeah.
And she's one of the dozen people in town with a functioning bullshit detector.
Oh, yeah. That was just one of the things that was driving me nuts about this book. It's like, Big Jim goes, oh, this is what happened. And everyone's like, yeah. And then Julia, who's a reporter, who, I will say, is about 1 billion times better of a reporter than What's-Her-Face in 50 Shades of Grey. Drawing parallels. She actually asks, like, a million questions every time someone gives her an answer to something.
It's true.
So Big Jim's feeding everyone bullshit, and they're like, yeah, that sounds reasonable. And then she's like, oh, what about these 10 things? And then it's clear that he's just, like, spinning lies. Right. And then everyone's like, oh, maybe she has a point there. But they never think to ask that question themselves. So she's pretty much necessary to keep everyone from just, like, mindlessly following everything Big Jim says.
I wonder a little bit why she didn't have a little more authority within the town as someone who's running a multi-generational town paper in a small town versus loudmouth Jim Rennie. It seems like her words should have had more weight than his in some ways.
There was one, was it, she'd, like, printed up that flyer calling Barbie's guilt into question after he got put in jail, and was putting the flyers up. She had, like, however many left after they burned down the office, and the little cop thug guys were tearing him down, but it said that some people managed to get a hold of them and read them and then pass them around the town until, yep. Like, people basically read them until they fell apart. And I was like, oh. Okay, so at the town meeting, there's going to be this big uproar of, like, a lot of us think he might be innocent. And then everyone was just like, oh, Big Jim is right, he's guilty, he deserves to get killed for it. And I was like, I thought everyone was reading her objections and agreeing with her.
It seemed to be written in a way where whoever played the crowd the best was going to kind of win that scene.
Yeah.
And so maybe if there'd been a good guy demagogue to oppose him.
Yeah. Well, the only person who tried was Andrea, and she didn't get very far before all hell broke loose. So, like, it felt like every time the good guys had the opportunity to, like, you know, start swaying people, the opportunity did not take them very far.
Yes.
But, I really liked Julia. She was kind of, you know, hard-nosed reporter woman, and
she was upset and not trying to hide it.
Yeah.
Like, every time Colonel Cox called her, she would ask him a ton of questions and kind of just basically tell him to go fuck himself until he actually would tell her something, too.
Like, hand me to Barbie. No, not until you tell me what's going on. He's like, oh, God. Okay.
He's not carrying his phone. I know. Isn't that sad? I guess you have to deal with me. He's like, you're such a pain in the ass. I know.
I'll tell you, but don't tell anyone. I'm printing it in the newspaper tomorrow.
Damn it.
Damn it, woman. Yeah. She's a fun character. And I would say, aside from Barbie and Big Jim, possibly the most important person?
Yeah, I think that's a fair thing to say.
There are a couple others who are pretty important, in a big, oh my gosh, group cast. It's it's hard to, you know, like, start ranking people and you get aside from, like, the protagonists and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, if you're gonna point out the handful of most important people, Julia is in that group, and Rusty Everett is probably
the next person in that
group. Yeah, he's a physician's assistant who ends up being the most highly trained medical person in town once all the... Well, yeah, basically once things start to develop.
Yeah, and the only competent... Well, the only, like, doctor dies.
Right.
So, yeah, I guess this happened on, like, the Dome falls on a Saturday, and a lot of people leave town on Saturday to go shopping or do whatever else, and apparently the hospital was running on a skeleton staff because almost all the doctors were out of town. Oh, they were at the, like, the firefighting demonstration.
Yeah, there was... Exactly.
Out of town. And, yeah, so it ends up that, like, the only doctor left is this really old guy, and then you have Rusty, the physician's assistant, and the one EMT, a nurse, and, like, two candy stripers.
Right.
And that's it. And then the doctor dies.
Right. I guess it's a good thing it's a small town.
Yeah.
And a small hospital.
Also, I guess you could make the argument that even if Rusty's medical administrations had not worked or killed the patient or left them in pain, in the end, it probably wouldn't have mattered too much.
Yeah.
They probably would have died anyway.
I know. It just occurred to me that maybe we should have put a spoiler warning in place.
I also thought that.
But I guess no time like the present. This is one of the... It's recent enough that we'll just say, hey, spoiler alert, stuff happens in this book that
is pretty crazy.
There are many deaths, and if you don't want any of those spoiled, I don't think we've specifically spoiled any of them yet, but
yeah, none of the big ones,
you might want to bail before you get too much deeper, because we're about to start revealing some of those. For example, basically the whole town dies at the end.
Yeah, except for like 10 people.
BT-dubs.
BT-dubs. The entire town dies.
Basically.
And that's not an exaggeration. It's like, oh man, everyone in that book died, but you know, only 5 people died. It's like, no, everyone in the book pretty much dies.
It's like... Yeah, actually, that might spoil something else, so I don't want to make that cross. But, you know how it's the cute thing to do sometimes? And someone says, oh, what are you reading or watching? Okay, what happens in it? Everybody dies.
Yeah, yeah.
No, in this, everybody dies.
Yeah, well, if you said that, you'd be pretty much spot on. So, there's that. Let's see. Any other characters? I mean, there are a lot of other characters.
There are a lot of characters. Maybe we could just touch on one quick quality for a couple of the ones that we kind of liked.
Yeah, I guess big one of the important things about Big Jim Rennie is that he's the town's second selectman, and I didn't even know this was a thing. I guess selectmen are a thing in the Northeast or something. They're not a thing in the Midwest. We'll just say it that way. I've never heard of a town selectman. But he's the second one. So there's a first and a third one, and he needs both of them kind of in his pocket to effectively corral everyone. So in this book you have the first town's first selectman, Andy Sanders, and his wife gets killed at the very beginning of the book. And then his daughter also gets killed, like, pretty much at the very beginning of the book.
Yeah.
And he's just kind of the nice, friendly dude who loves everyone.
Yeah, he's an affable dope, is what he is.
And that's why he got elected, was because people really like him.
He sounds likable.
Yeah, and Big Jim even notes, like, he would never get elected if Andy didn't vouch for him, because people don't like Jim that much. Because they can kind of tell he's a little cold, but... And he's so friendly. So, but he basically does everything Jim says, especially after he discovers that his wife dies, and he's really upset by it. And he makes the kind of hilarious character turn of becoming a gun-toting meth head at the end.
A sequence of events that I'd rather enjoyed myself.
And then the town's third selectman is a woman named Andrea Grinnell, or Grinnell. And her main thing is that she's addicted to painkillers. So Jim's able to, you know, manipulate Andy because he's such a friendly guy, but he's not too bright. And then he's able to manipulate Andrea because she's either, you know, high or just not that strong-willed.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how Jim manages to grab power in the town in the first place.
Yeah. And then Jim's son, Junior, who is mostly notable for being a deranged, insane person through really no fault of his own.
Yeah.
He and his glioma pal.
It's like a tumor that...
Big nasty brain tumor that is altering his behavior and his perceptions and...
Yeah, it starts at the very beginning and gets progressively worse until it's essentially like popping his eye out of his head.
Yeah.
And making his brain explode.
Yeah. He's been getting migraines that aren't migraines for a while now. And I guess it just so happens the dome fell during the week where this tumor would have killed him anyway, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. And he has a bunch of little cronies who are all despicable people and do not have the excuse of a brain tumor.
They're just thugs.
Yeah, they're just pieces of crap. and there are a lot of them, actually.
Yes.
Surprisingly. I mean, you just have, like, his main four friends who get named and are kind of indistinguishable from each other.
Fair enough.
But then as Big Jim continues to, you know, grow the police force to his liking, to people who be loyal to him, just more and more, like, of these, you know, young thug-type guys who are all just, like, assholes. I was kind of surprised the town had so many young dude assholes in it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's more manipulable, manipulatable. That sounds better. I don't know. Young guys, like, a couple of them are still in high school, even. It's kind of the, okay, well, we're in charge, and, like, one of the first things we're going to tell you is not to take shit off of anybody. Well, if you're a 16-year-old offensive guard for the football team who's like twice the size of any other person and you've just been told not to take shit off of anybody, more than likely you're going to act like a dick.
Yeah.
So,
most 16-year-olds act like dicks anyway.
In all fairness.
And not an insult to 16-year-olds. Like, that's just how you do.
That's right.
When I was 16, I was a little piece of shit.
Exactly. I was a dick.
No judging. It's cool.
Yeah, just go enjoy your dickery.
Just don't become like a weird stormtrooper cop person,
right?
And beat the shit out of people.
Part of the runny youth.
Yeah.
Let's see. Joe McClatchy, who is kind of a archetypical character to some degree, but the smart kid.
Yep, the smart teenager.
That's a trope that frequently irritates me, but in this case I actually didn't mind it so much. Maybe that's because he came across as being smarter than the adults, but while still being a kid, because usually you see that trope in more YA stuff, and it's like, oh, well, this 13-year-old is going to figure out all this stuff none of the adults can, and then he's going to go do something about it. In this case, he figured out or had ideas about things that were just as valid or more valid than things the adults thought, but the adults still had to, you know, fucking be adults and go do something about it.
Right, like, you know, they still need to get driven a place or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, the other thing, I guess, is the fact that he's 13, and he acts more or less 13, and he never has to, like, he figures stuff out, but he never has to do anything, like, you know, he doesn't have to, like, hack into the Secretary of Defense's computer, right. Like...
His uncle isn't Inspector Gadget.
Yeah, yeah. And I think sometimes with those, like, young kids who are super precocious... They tend to be sometimes even younger than 13.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you start going, like, okay, like, a 10-year-old, not gonna do that.
Right.
But a 13-year-old, like, well, you know.
Right.
They're kind of on the verge of something, so.
Well, it's, yeah, I agree. I mean, 13's an age when it's believable that a smart kid, I mean, because he's really smart, but he's not precocious in the way, like, a boy genius sort of thing. Yeah. And it's a sort of age where he could believably be doing that.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Barbie hands him the Geiger counter and says, hey, go try to collect radiation samples. And his friends have to be smart enough to, like, you know, follow the needle and know how to work the machine and stuff, but they don't have to be, like, the smartest.
Right. Well, let's be fair, a 13-year-old could probably figure out a Geiger counter more easily than your average adult anyway.
There's like, just press some buttons on this thing.
The nuclear age equivalent of programming the VCR. A joke that is now, like, at least 15 years out of date.
It's programming a VCR.
If he can program a VCR, he can damn well figure out how to put on a condom. I think that's the original form of that joke.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know.
If he can use the internet, then he can...
If he can use the internet, then you might as well give him comprehensive sex ed, because he's seen worse things than you can ever imagine.
Oh, God. The worst porn ever. So I guess to keep it on track, if there's porn of everything, is there porn of Under the Dome? That's what I want to know.
Indubitably.
Someone written some slash fan fiction Under the Dome.
What would the porn parody of Under the Dome be called?
Under the Cum? I don't know.
I don't know either. That's kind of a hard one to convert, actually.
Under the D?
Under the D? Under the something? Okay, that could be a new segment in every episode, but we'd have to actually prepare for it.
The porn title.
So it's never gonna happen. Yeah. What would the porn parody of? I was just thinking, what would the porn parody of 50 Shades of Grey be called? I was like,
Oh, wait a minute.
What would the non-porn parody?
What would the normal version of 50 Shades of Grey be?
I don't know. Whatever they call the movie.
50 Shades of Stupid.
I'm assuming it's not going to be NC-17, at least.
Probably not. You never know, but I doubt it.
Anywho.
Yeah. Characters.
Yeah, characters. I remember you saying you really liked Piper Libby.
Yeah, she's the Presbyterian pastor.
She's the non-Bible thumpy pastor.
Yeah, so there are two churches in town, and one's like the super rich mega church with like the crazy pastor who whips himself, you know, the radio station in town that's insanely high powered. And then you have Piper Libby, who is with another denomination and is just a pretty cool lady in general. Is briefly alluded to that she kind of had her own tragedy in her past. Her sons and husband, excuse me, died in a car crash. Does that sound right? And since then, she's been struggling with her belief in God. So you kind of have, like, her struggling with that and trying to help people. But when she tries to help people, she actually gives them, you know, legitimately good advice and isn't just like, oh, God will show you the path. Okay, bye. I thought she gave pretty real and human advice, so I appreciated that about her.
And she has a temper problem.
Yeah.
Though in this case, her rage bubble burst when she heard about, you know, cops gang raping a young girl, which,
yeah,
to be fair,
pretty good reason to get mad.
Would burst a rage bubble in a lot of people.
Yeah.
Any other characters we need to touch on, or shall we move things along here?
Go ahead and move things along.
Alrighty.
To moral issues.
Moral issues? I thought we decided we didn't have any.
Yeah, none.
No.
Well, I'm going to bring up the ladies. The ladies? I like bringing up the ladies.
I like the ladies.
Again, I don't know who's listened to The Stand or whatever, but I decided that there wasn't a great balance of men and women in that book. There tended to be a lot more men, and the women didn't do as much. And in this book, the balance is much more even as far as characters go. Of the people who kind of agree to join Barbie and figure out what's going on, I think the final count, there are slightly more women than there are men. And when Ben and I were thinking about it, most of the characters in the book who are, you know, competent, willing to reason things out, stuff like that, tend to be women, whereas, like, pretty much all of the bad, douchey people are men. We're talking about all those cops who are getting so full of themselves. Pretty much all of them are guys. So, in the end, you kind of actually have women coming across as looking better, maybe?
Yeah, well, I mean, in, I guess, the opposite of the, I want to say classical, without maybe delving too deeply into what exactly time period that would be, but it's almost like the opposite of the classical misogynistic view of women, where the women in this book were, like, the cool-headed, rational ones.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of being the emotional ones who need to be helped with things, they're the ones who are going, oh, let's slow this down and take a step back.
Yeah.
What's really going on here? We have solutions to offer.
And, you know, a couple of them are moms or whatever, but none of them were following into that trope. And they were all doing some pretty badass stuff, so I gave that a thumbs up. I was thinking, I wasn't sure exactly how to view some of the other stuff concerning women in the book. We were talking about one of the girls gets gang raped by, like, four of those dumb cop people. And then there are a couple other scenes that, like, mention or hint at it. And it's not a super prevalent thing in the book at all. But it is, that rape scene at least, is pretty disturbing, and I probably could have lived without it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really uncomfortable scene, and part of that is just because we're people who are uncomfortable by the possibility of that, I think.
Yeah.
I do think that with a lot of authors, that is a kind of shorthand for, oh, here's a sign that order is breaking down because rapey stuff is happening.
And yeah.
We all know that's bad, so this is showing you how bad things are getting and that it's getting out of hand. And, I mean, it's effective, assuming that you, I mean, it's, I guess what you would look out for, and I think what we don't think happened in this book is if you're just throwing it out there out of sheer laziness.
Yeah, if you're using it, like, as a plot device, or you're making it happen to a female character because something needs to happen to her, it didn't really feel like that. As hesitant as I am of, you know, rape in books in general, not just from male authors, but I'd say the fact that it's not, you know, all over the place in the book at least gives King some points in his favor.
And then there were maybe, I guess some hints of bullying, maybe more abuse of authority in the case of this book. Especially, you know, the young cops kind of running wild.
Yeah.
The ultimate resolution of the story really coming out of Julia and Barbie remembering episodes of, in Julia's case, I think bullying is a reasonably fair description. In Barbie's case, again, more abuse of authority and kind of a, he's had first-hand experience with what happens when, I guess, intense emotions in a small space get out of hand.
Yeah.
From his time in Iraq, which is probably part of the reason he has trouble settling down and feeling comfortable in normal society.
Mm-hmm.
And also that the dome was put in place by alien children who are maybe being kind of cruel in the way that children are kind of good at being, mm-hmm. without really intending to be.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that constitutes bullying. Actually, I would say it doesn't, because it's likened more to frying ants through a magnifying glass.
Right, and, you know, in the case of these, like, alien children, they don't really know what they're doing is causing so much trauma. Or they don't seem to understand it anyway.
Yeah, which kind of rolls over into the themes a little bit here.
Yeah.
Because cruelty of children, maybe cruelty in general to some degree. Mm-hmm. The idea that, you know, I took that one step farther and said maybe even just the idea of, like, the smallness and insignificance of people represented both in the literal sense of, oh, well, here's an alien child who can, you know, toy with an entire town.
Mm-hmm.
And the humans are powerless. Humans who are, we like to think, intelligent thinking creatures can't do a damn thing about it.
Yeah. And the analogy to the ants is, like, was really good for me anyway, where they're saying, well, you know, when kids are frying ants, they're just doing it for fun, but, like, what if the ant turned around and was like, hey, stop it!
Yeah, you're killing us!
Yeah, and so in this case, like, Julia is trying to do that with this particular situation, trying to make, you know, the kids realize, like, what they're doing is a form of bullying and not just, like, a fun thing, you know. The ants are shouting back, so.
Yes. And then maybe a little bit in the smallness of people, also in the sense of just the shitty way that people start acting the second they're removed from society at large, and there are not really consequences for them doing shitty things anymore.
That's true.
Like, you can now literally get away with murder.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You can murder someone and people might not even notice.
Hey, if that was the case, I hope I wouldn't, but I don't know. Maybe I'd Lord of the Flies it.
And then one of the questions I had actually was, what exactly are the themes of the book when you take into account this explosion of the meth lab? Because a lot of the characters are doing things throughout, you know, they're trying to act reasonably or, like, be kind or whatever. And they might be making some headway, they might be making none. But then the meth lab explodes and kills almost everybody. So is the theme, like Ben was saying, insignificance? You can't do anything to stop this, like, horrible thing from happening? Or is this, like, trust and friendship and stuff like that actually coming into account somehow?
Yeah, so, like, the little, like, all these little heroic acts that, you know, the few people that survive are able to survive because of those, I guess, ultimately.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, I really am not willing to commit to exactly what my takeaway is supposed to be in a thematic sense. Maybe there's not supposed to be one. Mace is one of those books that is entertainment driven and we're not supposed to worry about the theme this hard. But if you do start considering that theme, it's really hard for me to come up with a
more positive
counterpoint. Yeah, because either of these small heroic acts that save the few people that get saved, or you have everything that people do basically being meaningless and just a plea to, for all intents and purposes, a higher power being what saves you in the end.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Me neither. Alright, so, I guess just a couple quick points of interest.
Yeah.
You know, the rapidity of the breakdown of society within
is real fast.
I mean, it's like a full-blown police state in 4 or 5 days.
Yeah, is the dome even over Chester's Mill for, like, a full week? Maybe a full
week? Maybe a full week, actually.
But not more than that, certainly.
Right. And, I mean, part of that is that Rennie sees the opportunity and tries to seize it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And right away realizes, well, as long as this dome is here, no one can do anything to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, even some of the things that were less about the breakdown of society, like the fact that people were suiciding by day 4 or 5. And
yeah.
Like, oh, I guess we're going to be here forever. I mean...
like, why wouldn't you wait another week?
I know, that's the one that's... that's probably the element that I thought was the craziest. I mean, I could see the people who lost a couple family members and saw this dome and went, the fuck it, I don't want to find out. But, like, the couple that owned the more successful car dealership in town, uh-huh, killing themselves... like, to me, that was, well, wouldn't you, like, wait until it'd been 2 or 3 weeks and supplies were maybe starting to run a little short? Yeah,
and then, like, do it before you had to starve to death or whatever. Right. But still wait for a while. That's what I would think, too.
Right.
But, you know, maybe in that situation you can't think rationally like that. We don't know.
I don't know. And we mentioned the town selectman becoming a... short-term meth head before the thing ended.
He was smoking so much meth.
Yes, he was.
Like, I seriously don't know how that guy did not die from an overdose. Well, in the, like, 2 days he was a meth head. Right.
Like, on the first day, really.
Yeah. He was, like, smoking from the pipe, and then he got handed, like, 3 joints, which were, like, pot and meth all, like, laced together, and he smoked, like, all 3 of those in, like, 10 minutes or something.
Which caused him to pass out.
Yeah, he did have, like, a seizure, but then he woke up and just smoking meth like, yep, crazy again. I don't think he would have been very long for this world, nah, had he?
Doesn't sound like it.
Lasted any longer.
And then the, couple of little sub-chapters from the perspective of the dog, which...
Ben loved.
I quite enjoyed. It was a good representation of a dog's thoughts as far as anyone could possibly, yeah, know what a dog's thoughts are.
Plus he had the dead voices talking to him.
That was like the one supernatural thing.
Yeah.
Most dogs can hear dead voices. One word, dead voices.
Yeah. And they like recognize it and are cool with it and just like, you know, go about their business. Like, go pick up the envelope, Horace. And he's like, oh, dead voices. All right.
All right, dead voice. Ooh, popcorn.
Yeah, exactly.
Damn it, dog. Try to focus. I'm a dog. I'm not good at focusing.
I can't help it.
So, strengths and weaknesses.
Well, I mean, my main thing, and I don't really know, like, how much of a weakness this is, but at the end, like, when everything has gone to shit and almost, you know, like, the last of the characters are clinging to life, I did start going, okay, so how much of the action in this book, like, really mattered? Because all these, like, political machinations and power plays between them and Big Jim ultimately come to nothing because the meth lab explodes and almost kills everybody. And so I'm wondering, like, are there parts in the body of the book that could be cut out and made the book shorter and work still, or, you know, be just as good or better? So that was something I had. I don't really know if it counts directly as a weakness.
Well, it's a question you almost have to ask with a 1,000-page book.
Yeah.
I mean, could you tell this story in 500 pages instead of 1,000? Probably. Would it be as good of a story? I would argue it wouldn't in this specific case.
Yeah, it's hard to say.
It reads easily, that is, I guess,
very true.
A thing Stephen King is renowned for.
And I read the end of the book super fast, and it wasn't until, and I was really interested in it, and then it wasn't until I finished reading the book and put it down that I was like, I wonder, like, about the structure of this book now. And then a couple other things, one is that I thought the banter between the young people, Joe and his friends, 13-year-olds, was pretty bad.
Like, laughably bad.
Yeah, kind of cringeworthy, almost.
Absurdly bad.
The way they all talked in this way that was supposed to be cool, I assume, but just came across as lame.
It was definitely an old person's conception of what skater teens sound like.
Yeah.
And... like, usually happens when an old person tries to engage in kid speak, it is comes across as painfully inaccurate.
Yeah.
It's like when someone's dad tries to be like, yeah, punk, what's up? And you're just like, no, boy.
Yeah, like when kids are hanging out and like the dad walks through and he's like, what's up, my homies? Right. And all the kids are like, oh, God, get out.
And with, I mean, we're talking about 13-year-old kids having interactions. You don't even have to be that old for that to apply to you.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm 31. If I tried to talk that way to 13-year-old, it would be painful.
I was actually just about to say that, like, I think I've safely now passed the threshold where if I tried to talk to younger people, they'd be like, you don't know the slang.
Right. I mean, would you get a certain degree removed from it if you want to be cool, then don't talk like they do.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to them like they are other adults. They usually like that.
Go up to me like, who wants to get turned up? Yeah.
Well, that's pandering a little bit. I don't know. I'm not going to endorse that, just in case.
Oops. And then the other thing was that, so we were talking a little about the alien children plot line, and the fact that, you know, the dome is put there by alien children or whatever, like, doesn't necessarily really bother me. I don't really know what else I would, you know, prefer it to be instead. But I did think that, like, the reveal of who they were and them figuring it out and then in the end, like, asking for them to lift it did seem to me, at least, to come a little out of nowhere. And I would have liked a couple of places of a little more setup earlier in the book. So, you know, even just, like, they're the ones who make the, you know, ants under a magnifying glass comparison. And even if, you know, you just maybe seen, like, Rusty and Linda's kids earlier in the book magnifying ants or whatever, you know, the case is. Just a couple little things like that. So you kind of get an idea. Not so that someone would be like, I predicted the entire thing from the beginning. Right. But, like, you know, just, like, a little thing here or there. And then towards the end when they start talking about, like, oh, you know, I feel like I'm under scrutiny and blah, blah, blah. And here's Julia's story and here's Barbie's story. And then it would all feel like it came together a little more.
Yeah, and I think that's a valid question or even criticism. I suspect there's a contingent of folks out there who have a problem with just what the ending is.
Yeah.
Whether they thought it was set up well or not.
People seem to have problems with Stephen King endings.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if he's as bad at endings as some people think, or if a stray thought I had is that maybe just with some of these premises that there's no graceful way out. It's like, I'm going to put a mysterious dome over a town and it's impenetrable and stuff's going to get weird inside of the dome. And, okay, and then where'd the dome come from and how's it going to go away? That's honestly not that important to the story I'm trying to tell. So I guess I'll just slap something together at the end so there's an end to this book. I'm pretty sure I don't want the dome just to stay there until everyone dies inside of it. Though, I don't know, maybe he did. Maybe that's why he killed so many people off. One of his test readers was like, Steve, you can't just have everybody on the dome until they're all dead. And he's like, well, I can come fucking close to it.
Oh, yeah.
Just angrily murdering that test reader's favorite character.
Like, yeah, thing. Who's left? On the upside, though, it is a very readable book. It's pretty compelling. I mean, something like 1,300 pages long, and I finished it, I think, in less than a week, so you know, the story definitely grabbed me and the characters definitely grabbed me. And I didn't start thinking about these, you know, questions or weaknesses or whatever else I've been bringing up until after I finished reading it and then started thinking about it. But while I was reading it, I was just like, oh, no! Yeah.
You weren't, like, grinding your teeth and going, why didn't he foreshadow this more?
Yeah. I was like, please live one character, yeah. Please.
Just one. All right, so, I mean, I agree. It's an enjoyable book. And I feel, when we're talking about some of these weaknesses, I actually feel like we're nitpicking a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, I mean, if you're looking at it as literature, if you're writing a paper on it versus just, wanty something easy to read.
Yeah.
then those are things you definitely have to, those are points you have to raise.
Yeah.
So questions for the book, the main one, really the only one, since almost everyone died and we know where the dome came from, is what kind of life do the survivors piece together afterwards?
Yeah, really fucked up ones, that's my guess.
Yeah, one full of nightmares, probably. Alright, so your verdict?
I thought it was an entertaining and compelling read. And I did want to point out, I mentioned several podcasts ago that I was reading this and finishing it up. And so I don't think I've read the book for like a month now or something like that. And I was able to talk about and recall pretty much all of the details. So I think that is got to be a point in its favor that so much of it stuck with me.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I had read it once before I reread it for the podcast. And when you're willing to read a 1,000+ page book a second time,
it's gotta be at least so good.
Yes, at the very least, it's a book that doesn't suck. It's certainly not one I had any trepidation about rereading. I knew it was gonna go down easily, so it, you know, at a minimum it has that going for it. I would probably recommend it to anyone who's not intimidated by the sheer mass of it. So what you reading right now?
I just started reading Chocolat by Joanne Harris. It is the book that apparently inspired the movie. I had no idea the book existed. But Scott's mom like bought it at the thrift store or something and mentioned it to me. And I was like, well, I like the movie, so just decided to give the book a try.
All right, well, I'm reading Mission of Honor. Yes, there are more of them.
More Honor Harrington.
I actually didn't know this one existed until fairly recently, but
apparently they're still being written, so you guys have that to look forward to.
Yeah, this one's 2010, but this is, if there's any more in the series, I don't think I'm reasonably certain that whatever one comes after this hasn't been published yet.
Yeah.
So you might hear about them again, but at intervals.
Yeah.
But, not surprisingly, I am finishing that up before I go on to anything else. So if you have questions, comments, corrections, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah.
then you can leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can send us an email, novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
You can tweet us at novelideaspod.
And you can find us on iTunes. Sorry.
Sleepy Gabs are sleepy.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. Yeah, I was going to say, you can find us on Twitter. No.
Nope, hold on.
That's what Ben just said. Just you can find us on iTunes. All you have to do is search for Novel Ideas in the search bar in the iTunes store, and we should be possibly the first result that pops up.
Hopefully. And if you do that, then rate, review, etc. So next week,
yes,
we will be doing the Never-Ending Story by Michael End. Endy? End?
He's German, but I don't know if that affects how you say his name.
Ende?
End? End?
End? Never-Ending Story?
yeah. And I guess we didn't mention this at the beginning of the episode, but we were supposed to do the Never-Ending Story this time and Under the Dome next time, but then happened to read Under the Dome first because I was reading the one copy of the Neverending Story, so. We're switching them up.
That's right.
It's cool.
That's okay. You'll like it or more than likely never listen to it either way, so.
Yeah, exactly. You'll either listen or you won't care, so.
On average, as a human being, you have not listened to this. So, I guess that will do it this time.
Yep.
And we'll see you next time.